Welcome to the Life in the Stocks podcast, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Matt Stocks. I'm the host, and the show features unedited, in-depth, candid conversations with a wide range of musicians, actors, comedians, and creatives. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to Life in the Stocks on your favorite podcast platform. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and indeed all major podcast platforms. Be sure to give me a follow on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok as well, at Matt Stocks DJ. That way you can keep up to date with all of my live Q&A dates, my DJ performances, and of course, who's coming up on the show as well. But without further ado, let's crack on with the show, shall we? Here we go.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
We have visual.
Can you hear me?
And we have audio.
Okay.
Yes. Happy New Year to you, mate.
Happy New Year, man. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
I got my dog over here, so he just kind of sits. He's pretty good at sitting right there, but if he bothers me,
he's out.
If you hear something, you sit. Be good boy.
Where are you now, Joe? Is this a purpose-built little radio room for your Live from Hollywood podcasts and other things?
This is my office, and then I record stuff here. And it's picture a house with, it's on the beach, and it has a little, call it the crow's nest or a widow's walk or whatever they call it.
Yeah, yeah, like a chimney with windows.
Yeah, chimney with windows. And then there's a staircase down there that goes into the bedroom.
Amazing. Hey, have you ever seen the Australian TV show Round the Twist? Have you heard of that? So
no.
It's a very surreal, very wacky, cult 90s family kind of sitcom soap series. And they filmed it in Melbourne. I'm in Australia at the moment. And the family in the show live in a lighthouse. And you can go visit the lighthouse. It's still there. They do tours of it. And it's just a beautiful space, and that kind of just made me think of that. There's something I love about unusual house structures, you know.
Yeah, this is the only house like it in town. Everybody, none of the houses here were ever very big or cool, because it's called Seal Beach, and it was like, it literally was. I thought this was like myth and folklore, but it literally was prostitutes and gambling, and so no one bothered to build anything nice. They were just like putting up whatever, keep their mistresses here. And then in Long Beach, they have pretty nice homes. Most of the homes are pretty nice, the older ones here. They don't have any old nice homes, but this one somehow bucked the trend in its old 1930s home. And it's unique. It's not big, but it's unique at least.
And what made you want to move to the home of prostitution and gambling?
Well, I grew up in the home of prostitution and gambling. So
right.
I moved to Hollywood, and I did that whole thing. My wife and I lived there for, well, I lived there for 20 something years, and then we got married and stayed up there. And then, like many people, you move to Orange County, or you just move away from the big city. It's this cluster. It's just so congested there now. You just cannot move around. So back here where the family is.
Well, please give Sandra my love. And I wanted to just say at the start, what a lovely afternoon I had with you two in Belize on the cruise. I've done that cruise a few times, and this year's one was especially special and memorable and wonderful for me. And that day was a real highlight, and you guys were so nice, and it was just a wonderful afternoon. So bless you.
Well, we have the same feeling. So my wife wanted me to do a bunch of stuff just now, and I go, I've got to do this podcast. She goes, podcast, you got to help me with this and that. And I told her, I go, it's Matt Stocks. She goes, okay, fine. Go ahead.
And it was her birthday just the other day, right? Did you have a nice time?
Yeah, Wednesday we went back up to Hollywood and went to a nice Italian restaurant up there. And then tomorrow she's having her big party. So that's what I'm supposed to be helping with. But
love it.
There's nothing left to do.
Well, it's been a very busy time of year for you guys since the cruise. Obviously, I saw you got up on stage with Steve Martin and Martin Short in Las Vegas, as you do. Very quickly, tell me about that. What happened there? I just saw a picture on your Instagram and was like, there's Joe living the dream.
Yeah, it was. We went out there to see that. We had bought those tickets. I got those tickets for Christmas last year.
Right.
2022 Christmas. And they were very far ahead of time. And then they were canceled because one of them got COVID. And then they made it in December. So we just had to drive out to Vegas, which is only about 5 hours, including stops from where we live. And we went to, so we went out just to see that. And we were in the audience, and then they asked for volunteers. And my wife just grabs my hand and starts going, this guy. Yeah. And so they picked me and went up. And it was like a Three Amigos. They put Mexican hats on us, and
right,
we did a Three Amigos dance, and it was pretty thrilling,
Kind of iconic, but, really, or not kind of, very iconic.
Yeah, it was pretty thrilling. And then when we were walking off the stage, the piano player came up and said, "Hey, I'm a friend of Josh Freese's. I'm a big fan of the Vandals." When they asked me what I did for a living, I didn't know what to say because I have like 8 jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what to say to Steve Martin when he asked me what I do for a living. I better have something good. And I was like, I don't know. I'm a TV producer. I'm managing Sublime, which is something, it's just now public and stuff like that. I'm in the Vandals. But right when he said, "What do you do for a living?" people in the audience shouted out, "The Vandals!"
Amazing. So that, well, I was going to ask if there was crossover there. So there were a few Vandals fans in attendance.
There were a few Vandals fans in the audience. And then I said, I play bass in a band called The Vandals. That's my occupation. And then later I emailed the keyboard player who said he was friends with Josh. And I told him this story. I'll tell you this story too.
Please.
When I was 12 years old, I begged my brother to take me to see Steve Martin at the Golden Bear, which was a concert venue in Huntington Beach, which is one beach south of Seal Beach, where I'm sitting right now. And then they had concerts there. And Steve Martin was this. So this is 1975. Steve Martin was on the Johnny Carson show quite a bit. And I used to watch him. And I just go, you got to take me to see this guy. Right. It's hilarious. So he took me, and then we saw the show, and it was so funny. Our faces are just hurting. And then they said, "You can stay for the second show if you want." So we stayed for the second show, and we moved up to the front. So now it's like front tables, and I'm 12, and I'm just like staring at this guy and probably making him uncomfortable. But
are you like the only kid in the audience, pretty much?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, not even close. There's no other kids. And then, I mean, by this time, it's like, the show starts at 11 p.m. There's nobody young, nobody old, nobody young. So at the end of the show, he tells his big zinger of a joke. I forgot what it was, but it's, you know, the closer. Everyone's going nuts. And then he starts dancing around, doing these little dances, goes up the steps to the backstage area. And then people are just going nuts. They want more. And then he turns around and he just goes, wait, stop. Everybody stop. Everybody stop. Shut up. He gets everybody to shut up. Complete silence. Starts creeping down the staircase. He's going, how old are you? And he points at me. I go, I'm 12. And he goes, oh my, I'm so sorry. I had no idea. We have a 12-year-old in this audience the whole time. That is terrible. Okay, I have a joke for you. 12 years old? Okay, here it goes. There's these two lesbians and they walk into a bar. And then everybody just goes crazy again. And then he climbs up the stairs and he leaves. So I've been carrying that with me for, you know, my whole life, of like one of the big thrills of and always wanted to, you know, talk to Steve Martin about it, but I never met him. But, you know, I got to tell his keyboard player, tell him that guy that was on stage with him is the same guy from 1975. If he remembers it or not, I don't know. But I got that off my chest.
Amazing.
So it was a great night for many reasons.
It's a full circle moment right there. And I'm sure you must have had those in your career and life as well, where you meet someone and there's a dot that's joined from way back in the past to the present. And it gives you new fodder for your show, doesn't it? Have you had any standout moments like that yourself?
None that I can recall. You know, it's one of those things that you meet people all the time and they go, I saw you here and I saw you there. And it's like, they have a memory of that night that is pretty detailed because it was the only one. And Chewy, come on. Just sit right here for a while. So they have and it goes like some guys, like are some of our substitute drummers are this way too. They have all these memories of some show you did in Japan or London or whatever, and they're telling you this stuff. So they go, and then you did this, and then you did that, and you're like, how does this guy remember everything? It's because that guy only played, you know, three shows or a week's worth of shows. He remembers it. And we've played hundreds and hundreds. So we're just like, I don't know. They blend in. And maybe there was something at some of them that make you remember them. But now I keep a diary so I can look them up.
Well, there's so much that I want to try and talk to you about today, Joe, because you are a regular Renaissance man with your finger in many pies, as you alluded to with your Steve Martin anecdote there. Going back to, you mentioned you threw Orange County in the mix a moment ago. Going back to the 80s there, that time, that place, that punk scene. Because the Vandals in the 80s was obviously, you know, different incarnation. You had the country thing going on. I love that record, by the way. yeah. There's that song Susanville, tell me am I wrong, is that basically the Beatles falling and she keeps calling me back again? It's basically the melody to that, isn't it? I've just seen her face, or I've just seen her, it's a song off Help.
Yeah, I would say you could be right, but it was written by someone who doesn't really like the Beatles and doesn't listen to the Beatles,
right?
And so it would have to be really subconscious, because that person was me. Now, the reason why I don't like the Beatles is too much overexposure to the Beatles in my life.
Right.
Like, too much. Everybody loves the Beatles. I mean, you get into punk rock, you get into it because you're trying to be different and you're so annoyed by the Beatles. And then MTV comes and it's all they talk about. MTV was like, every news break was further news on the Beatles reuniting, and everything was about the Beatles, a possible Beatles reuniting. And I'm like, I don't care. I don't want to hear about it. And I don't like the people at my school that worship the Beatles, with their Beatles t-shirts and their Beatles books.
So the Beatles were still a cultural lingering specter, even in the 80s.
Yeah, it was. Well, you know, it was. There were the solo stuff was still going, and I thought the solo stuff was good. I mean, George Harrison, Ringo Starr, and especially Ram by Paul McCartney. That's one of my favorite albums of all time. And I got into that stuff, but I was so burned out on the Beatles, because it was just, you know, everyone just, like, now people are a little more sophisticated. They don't pine over bands getting back together. You couldn't tease anybody with a news story about the Smiths getting back together or something like you could back then. The Beatles, like, what? Wait, there's news about the Beatles? Yes, there's more news about the Beatles getting back together. Evidently, you know, and they got some new little clue that's coming. Yeah. And it really it grated me. And but then when I started, you know, as a serious bassist, you start learning Beatles songs. And, of course, you see the genius in them after you try to learn. But before, when it's background music and you're annoyed by people at your school, you know.
So were you a punker kind of right out the gate as soon as you found that music, that scene, that culture?
I heard about it. Yeah.
Were you inspired and drawn in?
I heard about it at summer camp, and some guy said, "Hey, there's a band that plays at my school on Wednesdays, and they're called the Snot Puppies, and it's punk rock." So they got this punk rock every Wednesday at lunch. The Snot Puppies play, and we throw food at them. They love it. They love to just throw it. I go, "Are you kidding me? Repeat that to me." And it was Beverly Hills High School. He goes, "Yeah, this is what we do." And they love it. I go, "So that's what punk rock is. Punk rock, they play, you throw food at them, and they love it." And I go, "Yes." And he says, "Yes." And I go, "Okay." So I immediately run to the phone at the camp. It was one payphone. Call my brother, same brother who took me to see Steve Martin. And I go, "Tell me about this punk rock thing." Because I had thought punk rock was, it was written on the wall at my junior high. Like, so I read it in 1977. I read it on the wall. It says punk sucks. Then it says Kiss sucks. So I'm thinking, well, Kiss must be punk and Kiss does suck. So I didn't pay attention to it. And then when I heard that at summer camp, I called the brother. And then he said, "When you get home, you talk to Steve Olson, the pro skater that lives in our neighborhood. He's all into punk rock. He'll let you know what's going on. And by the way, Joe, you have a punk rock record. That Ramones record that I gave you is a punk rock record." And I go, "Wait, the one where all the songs sound the same?" He goes, "Yeah, that's punk rock. That's what's called punk rock." And I go, "All right, I got a punk record. I love punk." So I just decided. And I went home and I just got all into it.
I love it.
And that very same summer camp is where I met Fat Mike and played him his first punk rock albums. That was probably 2 years later.
Now, was Josh Brolin at that same summer camp? Because
Josh Brolin was at that summer camp.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
So that's in the No Effects book. Is Mike's talking?
Oh,
about,
is it? Is it?
Matt, Mike's talking about that summer camp, and I'm sure he probably does mention you now. Come to think of it,
yeah, he does. He gives me credit for turning him on to punk rock. He's very generous with that.
And he says also, yeah, Josh Brolin was there, and that Josh guy Brolin. Gore Verbinski was around at that time as well, right? He went on to direct all the Pirates movies. Was he at the camp, or was he just kind of in the punk scene making videos and stuff?
Tell you, Gore Verbinski was in the Loyal Order of the Water Buffaloes, which was a fraternal organization with guys in Hollywood, which was a bunch of, you know, basically a bunch of Hollywood degenerates, the Tex and the Horseheads, and a band called the Little Kings, and Fishbone was in it, and the Vandals were in it. And it was debauchery, you know, kind of like Flintstone style. Like, we will smoke cigars, we will swallow goldfish, we will eat pig's ears, we will eat, that's about all we ate. And then we will sing, you know, Johnny Cash songs and get wasted. And it was out of control. And Gore Verbinski was in that. So that's how I knew him from that. And he was, by, you know, far and away, the biggest success to come out of the Loyal Order of the Water Buffaloes. But the bar was low, so. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, so that would have been your equivalent to the Hollywood Vampires kind of fraternity, right? 80s, punk, country, low life, as you say, hell-raising.
Yeah, it was definitely. It was hell-raising. That's what it was. We were raising hell. And then we would do things like, we're going to have a benefit. I'm going to raise some money for charity. Because after a while, you realize, like, even the Hell's Angels raise money for charity. Let's have a beauty contest. Like, it was that, you know. So a beauty contest. We have to find Hollywood ladies that would be in the beauty contest. It wasn't very PC, I'll tell you that. It was like, well, during the days of the, if you had money, you'd be in the Friars Club. And Friars Club was doing the same exact things. So we were probably just doing whatever the Friars Club did. That was in Beverly Hills. And we were, you know, just Westwood is where our headquarters were. And we were trying to be like them.
At what age did you begin to formulate a strategy for a career and become involved or at least aware of the business side of things more? And we'll get into many of the other things outside of music that you're involved in and have done over the years. But to kind of go back to that point, you're in this debauched clique of wild young punks. Assumedly, a lifelong career in punk is not on the cards at that point. So when do you start to see, like, oh, if I'm smart about this, I can start sowing the seeds for a future here?
Well, what I did is I was watching TSOL do whatever they were doing. And they were in a neighborhood next to here, which is Long Beach, one beach north. And that beach, that area, it's not really a beach. It's just like, you know, there's no waves. People don't aspire to live on the coast there. They just like live wherever. So the, people would disagree with that, but that's, you know, my view of it. It's like, so in Long Beach, it's a little grittier than where I grew up. And so that's where TSOL was headquartered. Two guys from Huntington Beach, two guys from Long Beach. And, I got messed up with them, pretty early on. And I was like the drum roadie. We didn't know drum tech. We didn't know that word back then, but, basically drum tech. And then Todd Barnes was always trying to get me in a band, and he's the one that put me together with the Vandals. So when they did an EP, I thought that was glorious. They had an EP on Posh Boy Records, then they had their LP on Frontier Records. So when the Vandals got going, I thought we'd just do exactly the same thing. So I had this illusion that it's pretty easy. And and we did get an EP out. We got an EP out on Epitaph. And which the first record besides a Bad Religion record on Epitaph. And that was easy. And then it got on the radio and then it got played. And so then right away, it just seemed like, oh, this is, we're just, you know, TSOL is great, but they don't even have a radio hit. We had a radio hit. And then we put out another record.
You guys, Urban Struggle.
Yeah. And then we put out another record and then we had another radio hit. So we had two radio hits in the row. And in those days, if you had a radio hit on K-Rock, it would be like, it's not really going to go anywhere else. It's like maybe San Francisco would play it, San Diego would play it. The rest of the country was just lucky to get college airplay. So now if you got a hit on K-Rock, it goes all over the world and it goes all over the country at least. And back then, it didn't. So it was a little bit humbling, you know, cause you would go on tour and then, you know, some markets you'd be big, some markets you'd be nothing. And then so it kind of goes like this, and I'm about 18 or 19 at this time.
Wow.
And then, you know, after a while, I think our third record came out, and they did choose a single for it on the radio. And it was from that country record. But we had to put that country record out because our guitar player, he was just kind of, you know, evolving, and he was over the whole punk rock thing. And he didn't want to... He just didn't want to play the same old punk rock, and he wanted to play some stuff that would seem like it sounded like Gang of Four. And I'm like, I don't think our singer can do that. You know, I don't think we pull it off. I don't think we can pull that off. So we had a compromise. I go, what about these cowboy songs that we all love, like this Urban Struggle? And we just kind of, we write more songs like that. Would that, are you amenable to that? And he goes, yeah, I'll do that. You know, so that's why we made that a record that is so country, because it was kind of a compromise between musical styles.
I love that album. I think it's a great record. And that was an interesting time, wasn't it? Because punk had kind of played out in some ways. It had gone
and then,
macho and kind of reductive. And
but I thought if the radio would catch on to one of those country songs. And they're not that country. There's like cowpunk, you know. If they would catch on to one of those, I thought that would take us somewhere. And because I also thought they were good. And I go, I think we can do this. And I think we could be an alternative band with a career with these songs. And then when the record came out and our manager called me, he was a guy that later would go on to manage the Offspring and mastermind that whole, you know, rocket to stardom. He was a good guy, and he got the station to play one of the songs, but it was the song Shiite Punk. It was the only song in there that was not a cowpunk song. It was just like, man, those days we got to throw every song on there. We got to throw them all because we just don't have that many songs, and we just gotta.
Song appear on another Vandals album? Isn't it on another one? I'm sure it is.
Well, there is one song that's on there. There's a song called Lady Killer on there that appears on another run. Shiite Punk, I don't think does, but nothing that I can remember. But there was Lady Killer. We had a more credible DJ Scratch version of Lady Killer. The first one was fake because we didn't know how to do it. So we were like scratching up like across the grooves. And then for the second version of it, we got a real DJ. So they play Shiite Punk, and I go, okay, it's a good song, but that means they rejected our whole path that we were that we thought we could do with this version of the band. And then the guitar player kind of drifted away because, you know, he didn't like it. And then we got Warren. All of a sudden we got Warren, and we've got Josh Fries. And then after I'd already given up, then when we got those guys, then you're like, and I went to law school, and then there were major labels creeping around at that time going, these guys, mainly Warren and Josh, me and Dave were there like, these guys are, they're in the band. But look at Warren and Dave. I mean, look at Warren and Josh. Look at them. So then I think, I don't know what goes on behind closed doors, but people weren't having it. And so Warren and Josh, they put together a band with Warren and Josh and two other guys called Extra Large. And that band did get signed to a major label. And then we didn't care because Dave and I were like, you know, this is the Vandals, we're punk rock. You guys, everybody do whatever you want to do. And then they played in that, and that did okay for a while. And then after a while, it was just the Vandals were, you know, the chief band for all those guys. And then Josh started getting noticed by like Suicidal and Infectious Grooves. And then it became like, well, our drummer's always going to be in some other band, it looks like. So, you know, I just keep along with my other day job and stuff. And then, but it's then when Green Day and Offspring blow up in like 96, like it was 94. And then by the time it was 96, like our phone was ringing off the hook for tours and merchandise deals, and because of Green Day and the Offspring, mainly the Offspring, and Rancid and NoFX, you know, the whole punk rock's blowing up. And then we get the same agent that Offspring and NoFX have, Stormy Shepherd. And then it's just like, all right, let's make this a full-time thing for a while. So we did, we made it a full-time thing for at least 10 years, and we had a great time, and we did a lot of Warped Tour shows.
You rode that wave, didn't you? You rode that wave.
Yeah, we rode that wave. We're in the tour buses. We're out in Europe 2-3 times a year. We're in Australia all the time, Japan, and we did it all. And then I think when that period ended, it was because we played for the troops in Iraq, and at that point, all the European concert promoters started boycotting us because they thought, I don't know, I guess they thought we were running around and shooting children or something, eating babies. So that we were boycotted in Europe, and that was a big part of our business out there. We couldn't go there anymore. So we kind of just, at that point, we're like, let's make this a real part-time thing, because it's, you know, we just lost half our business. Mm. And I don't feel like starting it over again, you know. And everybody was fine with that. And then, you know, let Josh go do whatever he's going to do. Warren was out touring with No Doubt. as I know with Gwen Stefani. He was a musical director for Gwen Stefani's tour, and everybody's just doing their thing, and that's kind of the way it is now. Everyone just does their thing.
There's
even Chewy.
There's again so many little facets to that timeline you've just laid out. First of all, without going too far back, you, Dave, Warren, Josh, such distinct, unique, really kind of, you know, disparate individuals. It comes together to create this incredible whole. Dave, first of all, how do you and Dave connect? What's that guy's story? Where does he come from? Because he is one of the most just punk. He seems to just not care about anything. I don't know if I misread that when I see him on stage, but he is just like, whatever, dude. And I love that attitude about him. You could not get more punk than that to me.
And you can't even say, you kind of nailed it. And it's not like he's like, he doesn't care. Like, you're lucky I'm here. Honestly, he believes you're suffering because I'm here. I mean, that's really what he's, for some reason, you know, I ended up here and you have to listen to it. I'll make it as short as possible. I don't like it. You don't like it. Let's get this over with. Yeah. That's his attitude. And also, so punk rock, you know, our main problems with him is he's so punk rock. He doesn't want to do anything. He doesn't want to do anything that might make money. Something that might appear like you're trying. Like, that's not punk. Like, that's why we couldn't go. Another thing was we couldn't go, like, when bands were, you know, getting on the radio, like maybe Newfound Glory and Rancid and Pennywise and The Offspring. For us to do a radio campaign, it just would never work because that guy won't go and play a radio show. He's not going to do it. He's just going to say, why are we playing the radio show? Well, we're going to get more airplay. Screw them. I don't want more airplay and I don't want to go there. So you can either, this is my advice to people in bands. Just love the band you're in and don't pine about some band you wish you were in. And I love the band I'm in and I can't complain that my singer of my punk band is too punk to do this or that. You just go, you know what? Lucky to have him. And, but he is quite grumpy at times, but you know, you get used to it. It's like, you don't say like, hey, Dave's been in his hotel room for 2 days on the cruise and I haven't seen him. Let's go find him and tell him to come up and do a meet and greet. You know, you just don't do that.
Is that what he was up to on the cruise then? He was literally just hiding away.
Yeah, he doesn't come out. Room service, likes room service, and he likes hotel rooms. And he's like resting because he has two kids. And
he's just enjoying the quiet time.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, he's got two kids and a wife and, you know, he wants to.
And they weren't on the cruise. Assumedly, he was like, "I'm not bringing them. This is Dave time."
he needed some me time, so he did that. But I'll tell you one thing that the all four band members, I think Josh and Warren really did gel in their band Extra Large. Like you could see how that was, and the other two guys were they seemed to be more of the same, like a more cohesive. They look like a band that was, you know, going places. But our band with Josh and Warren and Dave and me, that's one of the things we have in common. There's probably, I don't know of any other band like this. There's not one tattoo in this band.
Love that.
Or a body piercing.
Love that.
So how does that happen? And we've headlined tattoo conventions.
Well, you're all just, you know, you're in it for the music and the creativity, at least the three musicians. Dave, I mean, Dave's, what is Dave's incentive, do you think? What's his drive? What keeps him in? He could just go, I'm out, I can't be asked at all. What makes him want to show up and still be in the Vandals, do you think?
I think politeness, generosity, like he's, you know, it's painful for him, but he's a deep down a generous person. So he knows that it would be very disappointing if we at the peak, because this is, believe it or not, this is the peak of our career. Our offers that we get to play shows are like, I would say 10 times what they were in 1990, in the 1990s. 10 times.
Well, so, deserved. Well deserved.
Thank you. It's like a pyramid scheme. At a certain point, you get to the top of the pyramid, and you're getting this big paycheck, and there's like a lot of bands at the bottom are really good, and they're not getting anything. You know, that used to be us. Now we're up here.
Yeah.
So he knows that would be very that wouldn't be a very bro thing to do to his friends, and we're all friends. You know, so he's just kind of taking one for the team and going, but you can't push him too far. And so we don't. And then, you know, I work, and sometimes I get really busy with the TV business. I get really busy. I can't do any shows either. So it works. And so basically, yeah, he's just being a friend to play, even though he's got so much anxiety about it. It's hard to be the front man. Have you ever been a front man?
Well, I'm kind of my own front man, you know, DJ and host, and everything I do is a solitary quest. So I do understand that notion of you're putting yourself out there, especially in this new world of social media, internet forum, critique, exposure, all of that. It's very easy nowadays for anyone who is on any form of public platform to just take flack for anything they say or do. And it is exhausting, and it can feel, if you're slightly shy or, you know, sensitive, it can feel like a personal attack on you because you're the one who's front and center out in the front line.
I'm not even know what he's going through out there. I'm just back there playing, you know, Warren's doing his thing. He's got the a different kind of job. And so everybody is just tries to be understanding of it, you know, because there's not that much at stake. But every year it gets to be like a little bit like just more, you know, my bigger shows, more money.
I love it.
But
how much do you think now with Josh being in the Foo Fighters, like that must already, are you seeing an influx of streaming numbers and like social media follows, like, because that data now is readily available. Do you think people are joining the dots and going, who is this guy? What's his backstory? Where's he come from?
I would say it's been pretty flat in there. Like, I haven't noticed but when we, his Instagram goes up, and then, I think we get a lot more activity, a lot more comments on things because, you know, people are a little, and then people think he's not in the band anymore. And then we just played two shows with them a couple weeks ago. And then that gets a bunch of people talking like, oh, he's still in the Vandals. You know, it's like, this guy's always been in some other band. I mean, we shared him with Sting for years.
Guns N' Roses, Devo.
Yeah, the Guns N' Roses was the best because they never played, but he had to show up from 10 p.m. to 4 a.m. and work on the Chinese Democracy album. But he could always get time off to do Vandal shows because it was just like on a weekend or something. So we always could count on him during the Guns N' Roses time. Then Sting and Sublime with Rome. Did that, and that was, you know, he'd be gone, and now he's gone. But to me, the Foo Fighters is kind of like his forever home. He belongs there, and you know, we'll only be able to share him with the Foo Fighters, I think, for pretty much the rest of his career.
Yeah, so, I mean, what a great gig for him, so well deserved. And I saw him play on Halloween night last year at the Hollywood Bowl with Danny Elfman, straight off the Kiss cruise, funnily enough. I'd just done the Kiss cruise, same sick man company, same boat, everything. Yeah. And it was Los Angeles to Mexico that way and back. And yeah, went to see him play. It was the first time I'd ever seen him play live. And just hearing that thunderous sound that he created within that group, in that setting, on that night, it was so special. And I saw it, you know, obviously I knew the guy was good. How can you not? But seeing him in that setting that night, I was like, yeah, this guy's really good.
and he's better now than he was then because he's kind of cranked it up a notch for the Foo Fighters. I think he just wants everybody to know that he's the guy. So he's put more effort into it than I've seen him put into anything. And he's working his ass off and every night, you know.
And you get to be in the rhythm section with that dude. How amazing.
He gets
to be in the rhythm section with you.
he's very grateful. No, it's I mean, that we play with the best thing about that is only really good drummers want to play with us, and they do want to play with us because people like want to fill those shoes and they want to play those songs, and so we get like Derek Grant from the Alkaline Trio, Brooks Wackerman from Avenged Sevenfold and Bad Religion, and then Steve-O from Sum 41, Australia's newest rock star resident.
Amazing. So,
I think he's going to be with us in Japan.
Love it. I saw Brooks with you in the UK at Slam Dunk. So that was
okay. Yeah.
And I saw Steve.
Yeah, so we have an embarrassment of riches in the drum section. We have had drummers that have fallen short, and but that hasn't happened in a long time. We got our core guys, and we kind of now just don't accept a show if we can't get these guys.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Now tell me about Warren, because that guy, he's been on the show. He on the boat with the hot tub moment. That was the crowning moment of the cruise for me. That was really something else. He is like a savant, genius, artist, creative force. What a unique and brilliant man. Must be a trip being in a band with someone like that. Where do you two first meet and connect?
Well, I first saw him when there was a place called Meadowlark Country Club that was having punk shows. They were like in the 80s. They were just one of the venues. It was around Huntington Beach that shows were happening. And it was a kind of a dark time for punk rock, 21 and over shows, which is never good. And he was there playing with a band called, it was Doggy Style or Double Freak. I think this might have been Double Freak because he was in these simultaneous bands. And the first guy I ever saw play with a wireless guitar. And I walk in the club and that band is playing. And this guy is playing, but he's on top of a cocktail table. And there's like a couple that looks like they're on a date. And they have to endure Warren standing on their little round cocktail table. He's up there going, doing his thing, wearing a dinosaur outfit. So, I mean, and this is back in the time when you couldn't just go buy a dinosaur outfit on Amazon back then. It was one his mom made. And so this is what I'm seeing. And immediately I go, we need that guy in our band. And eventually we got
him. Amazing.
And we had him we had two guitarists for a while. And our other guitarist, Jan, who founded the band, they overlapped for a while. And then he went off and has a career in a government agency that I'm not supposed to mention. And then Warren, you know, was just right there.
And
he's brilliant, and he's the funniest guy I've ever met. Like you if you ride in a van with him, just from the hotel to the airport, it's gonna like you want to write down these things he's saying, and I do write them down. I just write them down on my phone. I'm like, oh, the guy is a genius, and he keeps saying the funniest things I've ever heard in my life. So that's, you know, you can't beat that.
Does he crash? Like, because he expresses himself.
Oh, yeah.
He expresses himself wholeheartedly. Yeah. So much of the time, but there must come those moments when it's like a sugar low, like woo.
Yeah, and we got to be careful. Like sometimes it'll be a triumph of a show. You know, sometimes he's going all out and none of it's planned. So some of them fall flat. Some of them are like, all right, this one didn't work. But when they work, you know, it's like a high, and then people are going crazy. And I might say to them, hey, let's go out and go to the merch table and talk to people. And you got to be careful. And you think like, oh, this guy's on fire. How could he not want to talk to the people after that? But if he has a crash, you're not going anywhere. Just nowhere. He's going down. And so, yeah, very, very, very good question. He crashes.
And he obviously in the producing seat as well has done so much with the Vandals and outside. Did you two start Kung Fu together? Or was it more your thing and you just bring him in to produce all the albums?
I didn't really know how this would work. So we thought well, he'll produce the records. I'll do the business. And then
partnership.
Yeah. But then what I realized is like, you can't have the same producer produce all the, you can't sign bands to your label and say, and by the way, here's your producer. So that worked for like, you know, sort of Jelly Beans and then the Ataris and the Vandals, but then we started signing other bands and they want their own producer. So there wasn't really anything for him to do. He's not an office guy. So I just did most of it. And then he has a percentage of it and he didn't have to do anything.
Legendary deal for Warren then.
Yeah. Good enough. And then we sold it in 2017. We sold it to Cleopatra Records.
Right. I didn't know that. I guess record buying is not what it once was. Was that the main incentive there was just.
Yeah, it just got like, I think I was talking to a lawyer I was talking to someone in a band that was on our Warped Tour compilation that we did, the Warped Tour DVD that we released. I was talking to one band member and their lawyer back and forth about some concern. And I decided at that moment, I need to get out of the music business. I got to sell this label because these people are just people you don't want to deal with. You know, they're just awful. So I decided at that moment, I'm going to go back to television where I never met people like this. And then it took a while because then Napster and all that CD burning, I had to build the label up mainly by increasing income from vinyl. So when vinyl saved us, could put out a lot of vinyl, a lot of different incarnations of things. And then the label was valuable enough to sell. And then we did, and it's still on Cleopatra. It's still part of their, you know, label group, and they still sign bands to Kung Fu Records. So it's still a going concern and an exciting punk label if your band needs one.
And what about you guys? Would you just automatically go to that label to release what you would do now?
Yes.
Yeah.
And all we've released is a couple songs for compilation, you know, cover songs for compilations. And then we have some things that we want to release. Nothing, not like a new album or anything, but just stuff. And that'll go on Kung Fu still.
Right on. I'm noticing for the first time in our conversation that you're wearing a Cocaine Bear t-shirt. That is amazing.
Number Mark, one movie of 2023.
Mark from Devo did the music, didn't he?
Yeah, Mark. Yeah.
Were you involved in the film, or did you just love it?
I just love it. It's my favorite movie of the year. Just it was very moving from the very beginning when they killed the Germans. It was beautiful. I don't think all Germans should be killed by bears, but those ones, they got me. Like, these people are going to get clawed to death, and I'm going to laugh my ass off.
And it is based loosely on a real story, right?
Yeah, loose enough or good enough.
So when do you begin to work in TV and film, and how does that segue take place? Are you just around filmmakers and producers and people of that line of work being in Hollywood the whole time?
Well, I'll tell you what, if you live in Southern California, it's you're less likely to work in the TV or film industry than people who come from out of town, because they come from out of town with dreams and they give up everything.
Right.
And they're driven and they're a little more ruthless and cutthroat, and they're going to claw their way into the industry. And you're like, what? Why is everyone acting this way? It's just a job, you know, and then you might go off and do something else because you live here anyway. You know, you didn't move somewhere to, you know, the stakes are lower. I always want to work in television. But I went to law school, and then I worked at CBS Television directly after law school, where I was a talent buyer and a program negotiator, that they like to have lawyers do that. So I did that. And then when the Green Day and Offspring stuff started blowing up, I left. And then, but I always stayed connected with it. We made a lot of videos and movies and TV shows and stuff while at Kung Fu Records. But then finally I made my way back to full-time television, writing now, because you have to, if you're a lawyer, you have to leave TV to come back as a creative. You can't switch and say, I'm a lawyer, but I decided I'm going to start writing. No one wants to talk to you. That's not cool. They don't want to talk to lawyers. They don't think they're creative. So they're not going to read anything that you wrote. But by leaving for so long and then coming back, I was like, hey, look, the guy in the Vandals. No, what do you got? And then people would read it, and I got work. And so I've, you know, I worked for some true crime for Discovery ID, and then Ancient Aliens for 4 years. Technically, I'm still working for them, depending on how many scripts they send me and when that happens. But and then shows like Curse of Oak Island, and then some indie movies. And then I sold two shows to a network called Fox Nation. There's one's called not Ancient Aliens, but Alien Abductions. And then the other one is Monsters Across America. And these are like half-hour paranormal shows that I created, and showrunner, everything, director, writer. Nice. And that's been fun. But then this recently I got dragged back into the music business when I was able to put the Bradley Knowles' son together with Bud and Eric, the original guys. And it's not a novel idea. Other people thought of it, but I happened to be like have the right formula that where everybody would be comfortable doing this, and just like, let's give it a shot, see how it sounds. And then I partnered with another guy named Kevin Zinger, and we just took over the management of the live touring, which is about to launch. We're going to announce a big festival in January, and then the merchandising, the record royalties, the publishing, the marijuana business, beer business. It's almost a full-time job. So that's what I'm doing now. So I have to balance that with the TV stuff, and then, you know, Vandals stuff. And then I'm in a Morrissey Smith tribute band, which I don't have to spend too much time on. I just have to go to rehearsals and the shows, because I'm not in charge of anything in there. Cause
how old are you today, Joe, as we talk?
60.
How incredible to be 60 years of age and to be in the most fruitful, productive, creative, exciting, successful time of your life, considering everything you've already done, all those things you just mentioned there. And you were obviously in the throes of these sublime conversations in Belize when we were hanging out. You're on
yeah.
the phone and get, so I'm glad we can
yeah.
talk about that in this moment now. But the potential, especially with that brand, is so huge, because even today, everywhere in California, everywhere around the world, but especially in California, however many years after Bradley sadly passed away, you go into any restaurant, bar, you go into a taxi, that music is just still in the heaviest of rotation. It is culturally ubiquitous with that part of the world and that culture. And obviously, you know, Sublime with Rome has done good things. I toured with them actually in the UK, and Rome did a great job of bringing it forward. But to bring it full circle with Bradley's son, and as you say, with branding kind of merchandise opportunities, as well as the live stuff and the publishing, all of that, I mean, it's a pretty exciting thing to be sat on. And I feel like people, because it is Bradley's son, will really embrace it. And, you know.
Yes. I think people are very, very happy. We did one show, like a benefit where they played like 8 songs, a benefit for HR from Bad Brains at a small club in LA, and just kind of see if they like playing with each other. Turns out they like it. And so we're going to festivals. We'll see the next step. And I knew Bradley. I knew his dad. I still know his dad. I knew all these people, but you know, they always had all these other people to work with them and do stuff. And then it just kind of came my way. When it came my way through Eric, I just kind of, everything just worked. It was like it was destiny. So easy. Do you want to do this? Yeah. Do you want to do this? Yeah. How about this? Yeah. This giant festival. Do you want them? Yes. You know, the everything is very easy with these guys, and they've placed their trust in me and Kevin, and I'm very grateful, because it is a big deal, and they completely put their trust in us. And things like, they're like, remember Josh telling me, like, he like did a FaceTime or something, or a picture from Target. Look at this. You know, look on the wall. It's the Beatles, it's the Rolling Stones, it's Nirvana and Sublime. That's it. And that's like what they're featuring. And we were just like mind blowing then. And then that was before I became kind of in charge of this stuff. And I look at the numbers and I look at what's going on here. And it's like, I just got the biggest order from H&M department stores of any t-shirt thing I've ever heard of. I'm in the Vandals, you know. Just, you know, it's such a baby thing now that I see the real world out there.
And what's the phrase? Not, fuck you, money. There's that phrase.
Like, yes, definitely. One of the manufacturer said, as we were told, that it was like between the Rolling Stones and Sublime in the U.S. is like number one and number two for merchandise sales. And then we were kind of like, should we say that to people? I don't know. It seems like it's probably fake. And then we went to the company and they showed us the numbers, and he said, there's 3 bands, and it's the Stones and and Sublime and one other band. They didn't tell us that band, but I assume it's the Vandals. So. But yeah, I mean, this is like everywhere you go. So it's a different world for me. But it's kind of it's kind of like I could do it in my sleep, but you got to wake up there's so much work. You really, it's weird. You got to do it. Someone's got to do this stuff. Who's going to get the hotels for the, or not the hotels, the, that rent the homes for the big festival. Like, I got to rent 4 homes. Oh my God. So, you know, just stuff like that. I'm like, got to rent 4 homes. Wait a second. The Vandals played this festival and we got 1 hotel room for the singer. Like, I got to get 4 homes. Who's going to do that? Oh, yeah, I got to do that.
Yeah. Well, let's be real as well. You know, they're a real deal band with real deal, not rock star, but, you know, they're wild. You know, I don't know what Bradley's son's like, but, you know, Sublime are notorious for being the real deal. And so you have
Bradley's son is sober, thank God. And the other 2 guys are, you know, there's 2 different personalities. There's Bud, who is, his head is in the game. He plays drums like he's never quit. And Eric is just, that's the wild card. He's wild and
keeps things interesting,
you know,
for you.
Yeah, it's part of my job, just to like Wait, what do you want to do now? Okay, I'll make that happen. Like, woo.
Hey, you mentioned this earlier, and I want to circle back to it because I think it's important. You talked about playing the shows for the troops around the Iraq War, and I guess you did it after then as well and have done it since then. I think with something like that, now I think if a band did that, it would be fine. We obviously live in a very different world now where there is less black and white, kind of like you're a traitor to punk, rejection of, you know, like what is essentially, I think, an honorable decision. I think that people who put their lives on the line to fight for their country aren't doing it for political reasons. Often they're people who are from broken families, working class backgrounds. It's their best opportunity of a life and a way out of the shit show that they have to contend with at home. Like my dad joined the army when he was 16 because he would rather go and get shot at in Belfast than remain home in his situation. So, you know, it's not easy for these people. And that is the understatement of the century. So for a band like you guys to go out there who's so apolitical and just entertain and give them some relief and joy and something to distract them from the horrors of their day-to-day lives is a beautiful thing. And it's a shame that that got misconstrued and used ultimately against you guys. But God bless you for doing it, and God bless you for continuing to do it despite the blowback from within the punk, you know, police community.
Yeah, the squats circuit in Europe that went after us, and which was a shame because we played all the squats and we did that whole thing, and then they turned against us really fast. But when they did, and when it was all over, nobody regretted it. No, there wasn't one moment where we said, "Wow, what a mistake! I wish someone would have told us." It was like, "Screw those people! They will one day be ashamed for, you know, choosing this reason to destroy our career and our label over there." We had to bankrupt Kung Fu Records in Europe, and Kung Fu Records used to bring at least three punk bands over to Europe every year. So we were bringing, you know, Audio Karate and Assorted Jelly Beans and the Ataris, Tsunami Bomb, Apocalypse Hoboken, just like, you know, bands that probably few people have heard of. We're bringing them to Europe. We're and then after that, nothing. So, okay, good, great. We're not doing that anymore. And then Dave was like, shit, I didn't like going to Europe anyway. So he didn't care. And then right after that, after it all happened, we signed up and went to Afghanistan. And then we went to Frankfurt, played with the troops there, and just, you know, never regretted it.
And now you've got Ed Sellers booking you, who's a good friend of mine. I love Ed. So
yeah, Ed Sellers is great. And he just asked us if we'd like to go to England. And
Dave said, so, no, I'm all right.
Well, that's what I said. I go, why don't you describe it, and I'll hand it to Dave and see if he's feeling it.
Well, fingers crossed for Sublime over here soon as well. The final big talking point I'd like to end on, Joe, I love that you're a man of faith. There's few of you within the punk community. I love that you're also a business head and still a punk rocker. It's, I think, rare that you can marry those two things authentically and successfully. I heard Little Richard once talk about the deal that you make with yourself when you're in rock and roll and you believe in God, but you're doing, in some cases, the devil's work. Do you have to marry those two in an active, conscious way? Does it become a natural partnership for you? Like, The three different lanes of spirituality and faith and business, and then the punk rock community, which obviously you still hold dear and has, you know, raised you and given you this whole amazing life. How do you juggle all of those three things in a way that makes sense and is rewarding and enriching and inspiring?
Well, it's always a struggle. And I would say that, you know, when most Catholics go through a period right after your confirmation until maybe you're going to get married. And that's the time you're not going to mass and you're like just doing your own thing. And that's when I got in the Vandals And then it just kept going. And I probably, if I'd got in earlier or later, I would have been in a, not a Christian band, but I probably wouldn't have been in a, I probably wouldn't have been in punk rock, really. So I, and then one day I wake up and I'm like, oh, I'm Catholic and I'm punk. How does this work? I just try to do the best I can, but you know, some of our music is very unholy, and I try to keep it from going too far in that direction. And but it is something. It's something I'll even talk to my priest about. I go, this is what I'm doing, and you know, like, if I quit, someone else is just going to jump right in and do this, and you know. But some kids look up to me. Maybe I'm changing some kids' opinion of Catholicism, maybe. And then, you know, what are you going to do? So it's not like Little Richard.
Well, he was a wild man, wasn't he?
he just left. You know, he just one day he just said, I'm in the wrong business. And he left. But that didn't like, and then it didn't last. You know, so it's like, he couldn't be the Bible thumper his whole career, too hard. And maybe, you know, and then in the end, though, he did inspire a lot of people. And he probably brought a lot of people to the faith by, you know, just showing up and doing his thing. And I don't, you know, I'm not out like him. I'm also not like him out saying, hey, come to Jesus at this rock concert. It's just something that I do. And then sometimes I'll go like, oh, this is great. I'm in the Vandals. And I go, hey, this is like, what am I doing? This is like, this isn't, how does this glorify the baby Jesus? How does, could you tell me how?
Well, my take, Joe, would be, as someone who's recently kind of had a bit of a spiritual awakening and is exploring, you know, these themes in a lot more depth, for me, it's all about love and compassion and joy and understanding and forgiveness and all of these things that bring us together. And that is exactly what music does. You know, whether it's slightly offensive or sarcastic or comedic or not, the ultimate aim is to bring people together and to help people heal and express, you know, love and celebration of life and all of these things. And the Vandals absolutely do that in buckets and spades.
Thank you very much. And you'll know from, you know, from your English, right? English drinking songs, Irish drinking songs are filthy. So I just imagine how many, you know, fine priests.
Yeah.
Catholics, priests, Anglicans are singing these Irish drinking songs all the time. And there's a time and a place for them. And that's kind of the way I feel about the Vandals music. There's a time and a place, and it's not for kids. And they get in it, they find it, and they discover it. Then they're just like me when I was, you know, discovering Doors records and Frank Zappa and David Bowie when I was little. Yeah, it's definitely a time and a place, and not much different from the English drinking songs is the way I kind of rationalize it to myself. I don't write songs with curse words in them, like with a rare exception here or there for effect.
That always been the case.
Pardon?
Has that always been the case?
Yes. Like, but like a song like Anarchy Burger, say the F word in front of your mom. There's no substitute for that. I mean, if we're talking about what that message of that song is, there's only one word that you're going to say in front of your mom where you are a true, you know, quote unquote anarchist of the early punk rock scene. So things like that, you know, but in general, I always fighting for less filth, and just try to dig a little deeper and try a little harder to come up with something funny that doesn't resort to the pee pee poo poo filth. And I think it takes a lot of effort, and it's worth the effort. And so that's like something that I always try to do. And And so, you know, that's kind of the reason why I like the TV business. There's this like rule of all these things you can't say and can't do. I like working in that framework.
Well, it forces you to get creative, doesn't it? When you are limited, you have to think outside of the box.
I had a show I was writing for where they told me, look, you know who watches our show? 52-year-old African-American women. And I go, okay, all right, thank you. I'm going to go back and I'm going to write something for 52-year-old African-American woman. And I did, and I had a blast doing it. You know, it's like, give me the rules and make me work harder.
Love it. And on a closing note, business and success and punk rock. Those two, I believe, should be bed partners. I think that, you know, there's nothing in the punk rock rule book for me that says that you have to be playing squats with as small an audience as possible to keep it real. I think the whole goal of punk is to be yourself, to be authentic, to represent integrity. And betterment for the world. And to do that, you want to reach more people, right? So do you feel in your life like you have managed to retain a connection to the punk scene that you grew up in and also danced with, you know, the entertainment business in the ways that you have? And do you feel like you've married those two worlds successfully in your heart? And are you happy with the way it's all gone?
Well, I am happy with the way it's all gone. And then, I do, although I don't begrudge people that like Green Day that are making millions of punk rock. I don't care. I love it. In fact, there was a dust up and a couple of days ago from Green Day and the Vandals. Green Day played New Year's Eve and they were saying some changing their political words to some other political words. And it was like a big deal in the news and everyone's saying, oh, the Green Day is saying these political things. And then one guy on the Fox News channel said, Green Day is just a poor man's Vandals. And let me tell you something about their, you know, let me tell you something about Green Day. They're just a poor man's Vandals, blah, blah, blah. And he went on. Then that became an article in some thing or whatever. And we're just like, you know, we love Green Day. Our keyboard player at our Christmas shows is Jason Fries, the keyboard player of Green Day. You know, so in essence, we have part of Green Day in our band anyway. But it was really funny. And then like other promoters, everyone kept sending me the articles like, oh, it's Green Day versus the Vandals. I don't. It's like you guys do. They wrote great songs. They wrote money making songs. If you can write money making songs, then go and collect the money. I do have a lot of respect for bands that you know, probably more respect in a way that are in denial of any of that. And they're like, I won't do anything that takes me out of this punk thing. And in a way our singer's like represents that in our band. He's like, what is this? It's a punk band. And then he keeps you humble and goes, yeah, you're right. This is a punk band. Just keep it the way it is. And don't try this or that. And don't. But we do pretty good anyway, you know, just from hanging around and maybe not like. We did enough. We paid our dues. We have enough songs. The amount of money we're making now is more than I ever dreamed we would make. And it's still not enough to, you know, make you think like, oh, this is, you know, this is how I'm gonna make a living. But it's, wow, it's a well-paid hobby. And the Vandals is a very tight men's club, more than a band. And we like each other and we keep it that way. And we all get a kick out of each other. And I think that is more valuable than money. Of course it is. And we've always put that ahead of everything. Like, hey, we're still friends. Look at all these other bands. This is 40 years with this band. Like, it was like 1989 for 35 years, with the same four guys.
As he rubs his face.
Yeah. That's pretty valuable. 35 years, the same four guys. Still, we could get together tonight. We're all living about 15 minutes from each other. We will all get together tomorrow night at my wife's 50th birthday party. And we'll all be there and hanging out with each other and palling around. And that's worth, I mean, how much money is worth, like, having this, like, a feud with an old band member, you know, that kind of stuff. And I've had those with, you know, past members and stuff. And those are just hideous. So, that, you know, worth. And then I always think about, what caused that? Was it money? Why didn't I just, you know, if they wanted more money or if it were a dispute over money, why didn't I just give them whatever they wanted and open up my, because that's what Dave Quackenbush would do. He'd open up his wallet and say, what do you want? You take it all. What are we talking about here? We're friends. So, you know, a lot of, even though we gripe about our singer, we learn lessons from him all the time.
Yeah. He's
and as far as singers go, Warren always reminds me, we're pretty lucky in the lead singer lottery of life. We did pretty good.
Well, God bless the Vandals, Joe, and God bless you. And thank you for a lovely chat today. I've been really looking forward to this since meeting you properly on the boat. And yeah, it's been great. We'll have to do a part two in person if and when you come over to the UK. I'd love that. We could maybe even do it at a little club that I do live podcasts at and get a few people along and share some
stories. We'll get the rest of the guys in, or at least Warren, and have a chat.
Amazing. Great. Well, I hope you have a good weekend as well.
I'm working on a Glenn Matlock movie, so I might go over there for that at some point in the next few months. So it might be sooner than later.
Great. Well, please let me know if you do. I actually did one of these live podcasts that I'm referring to with Glenn at this club that I have in mind about a year ago. Great guy. So yeah, if you are heading over that way, please let me know and we'll meet up.
It's possible. Okay, well, thank you.
Happy birthday to Sandra again. Have a great night tomorrow, all of you. And
thanks,
till we next chat, dude. Thanks so much. Take care. And yeah, see you real soon. Tonight I'm gonna have myself a real good time. I feel alive. Ha, ha, ha. And the world turning inside out and floating around. Dancing through the sky like a tiger, defying the laws of gravity. I'm a racing car, passing by like lightning and lava. I'm gonna go, go, go. There's no stopping me. Running through the night, 200 degrees. That's why they call me Mr. Fahrenheit.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to Quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.